seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
You're welcome along to the Ryan Line every Thursday. The great Shane Ryan joins us to answer your questions. Get them in on the Discord channel to golfweekly@offtheball.com. Shane, the world is a very different place than when we last spoke to you.
I think that our Friday conversation should be a historical artifact. under the heading Ye of Little Faith. Although we had good reason to be of little faith, but wow, how things change. This is what a stunning Sunday. I can't wait. I've been looking forward to this podcast ever since he hit the winning putt.
We had an email in at 1 a.m. on Sunday night, Monday morning, which is probably just the appropriate place to start. Was that the greatest night of golf ever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, not night. I don't know what he's talking about, but
well, no, not it was, night it for was us.
Not. Yeah, I know. I do think, we're a few days on now. I think we can say that, yeah, there's still recency bias. I'm not pretending that we're over the recency bias, but what's better than that? I mean, what's better? You could argue maybe Tiger winning the Masters. For me, no. For me, this is the ridiculous drama of that day, plus the outcome, plus the drought ending, the history of that, plus competing the career Grand Slam. You know, the historical legacy is just on a different level, but the nuts and bolts, just the golf of it, the wild swings, the insane amount of choking followed immediately by the clutchest thing you've ever seen. It is unlike anything I've ever seen. I don't think I've had more fun or been sort of like more emotionally invested ever in a Sunday at a major than that. And I don't think it's close. I mean, there's nothing that remotely compares. I'm not even Irish, but I mean, I think everyone in America would agree, every golf fan, that's as good as it gets.
And you can go back through the other great major triumphs, and they all have their own particular storyline. And McGinley mm-hmm. very quickly referenced 86 and Nicklaus storming through to claim a last green jacket, a last ever major. But that was sort of, and again, I was too young, I was 4 years of age. My sense would have been that was the icing on the cake of the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
And doing it at that age was remarkable and special. And Tiger in 97 or Tiger at Pebble was a whoa.
Right, yeah.
Just never seen anything like this. Totally. This is a whole new world.
Yeah.
And we've had moments at majors since then, and Tiger in 2019, absolutely. Like that footage of him holding his putt on 18 and then the silence of the commentary team for the next 5 minutes as this wall of noise just enveloped Augusta National is as good as it gets. But this was not just the best sporting drama. Like the only thing I could compare it to was the 2022 Football World Cup final between Argentina and France, where you have the Messi storyline and
right.
the greatest player of all time getting over the line. And it's similar to that in that, you know, you go, oh, and Kylian Mbappe scored a hat-trick in that World Cup final. And scoring a hat-trick in the World Cup final is maybe one of the greatest singular achievements you can get in sport. And that's not really in like the top five best memories of that final, and it went this way and it went that way, and that's like this as well. Like, you know, you use the word choke. I was like, if anyone who thinks Rory McIlroy is a choker, it's very hard to sit down there after a Sunday night and go, well, you're wrong about that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
but also, nobody has ever shown more mental resilience to bounce back from that instantly.
That is, I think, the crazy thing. That it was a microcosm of his last decade in a way, where I think the remarkable thing. Well, like when we were talking on Friday, and then I had this feeling again on Sunday, it's like how often he puts himself in the position. It's not like he had a bad moment in majors and then disappeared, right? We've seen that before. He has been excellent for the last decade. He's been one of the best golfers in the world consistently. I can't really think of an extended period where he dropped off. He keeps putting himself back there and back there and back there, and he keeps having his heart broken. That's been the story of the last 10 years, and it was a story condensed into a few hours on Sunday where it's like, oh, my goodness, he double bogeys the first. Here we go again. He just keeps putting himself out there and keeps getting his heart broken. Oh, but then he gets it back. Look at him go. Look at the resilience. Then he, look at the shot on seven. I mean, what an unbelievable shot that was. One of the greatest clutch shots on the front nine, probably, in Augusta history. Then we come to 13. What the wisdom to lay up, and then he dumps it in the water, and you're going, it was just the same feeling Nathan I had at Pinehurst when he missed that putt on 16, where I go, there is something in the air. I don't know if it's Rory or if it's the golf gods or what it is. This man is cursed. Nobody should miss that shot, least of all Rory McIlroy. And you go, wow, he's dead. And then he bogeys 14. You're thinking, here comes Rose. Here comes Patrick Reed. I mean, it's all happening again. And then that shot on 15. The shot happens on 15, and you go, this is outrageous. And then he misses the eagle putt, but he still makes the birdie. And then it's all coming. He's got a great drive on 18. He puts it away. It's over, and he dumps a shot in the bunker. And then he does a good out. He say, okay. And then he misses the short putt, and you go, it's all happy. I mean, everybody knows this. I'm just rehashing things. But the emotional swings of that, again, the microcosm of all of this resilience, all of this pressure, this devastatingly bad pressure play coming back, and then of course in the playoff he makes the birdie. It had to end that way. This drought, completing the Grand Slam, had to happen this way. When you look at it, you look back and you think, well, St. Andrews would have been perfect, right? I mean, what poetry is St. Andrews? Pinehurst, he had it under wraps. Pinehurst is a famous golf course too. Win another U.S. Open, that would have been perfect. But really, nothing is as perfect as winning the green jacket, completing the Grand Slam, and doing it in the most Rory way imaginable, where he lost and won it four times, at least.
He didn't just complete the career Grand Slam. He did it in the best, most dramatic major championship we have ever seen.
I would have loved to have seen you watching that, Nathan, or Fionn, or...
Oh, it wasn't. Because golf is different to, say, watching a football match. And I remember watching the World Cup final. I was literally on my hands and knees on the floor at one stage going, I cannot believe. I was stuck to my couch, wide-eyed in disbelief. And to be honest, I think I was in a state of shock for the last hour or so, because I thought it was done. I thought it was done as he went into the back nine. I honestly thought this was going to be a Lowry-style procession and that we'd end up with that Tiger-style finale where he gets to go through 16, 17, 18, and nothing can possibly go wrong. Mm-hmm. And there's the adulation of the patrons the whole way around, and a coronation on that back nine of, yes, totally. We finally got there. And then to just have it all taken away with the most ridiculous, like the shot on 13. The shot on 13, that just astounding. Doesn't happen. As it was happening, as he was lining up to take the shot, I'm like the calmest man in Ireland. Like, this is as good as it gets. It's Sunday night. I'm lying on my couch. I'm watching Rory McIlroy win the Masters. And honestly, when he hit it in the water, I wondered, had something happened to TV and they had shown Bryson? And because there was no way this could... Oh, my God.
They got the wrong clip.
Yeah. And I think, look, it's a very modern success in that we see everything now. So we see every tournament he plays. We see every shot he hits. A camera's in his face within seconds of every big moment that has happened. And he has been so expressive, particularly over the last 6 or 7 years. He hasn't hidden his emotions, whether it's at Ryder Cups and the tears of joy or the getting almost into a fist fight with the Americans. What happened in Port Rush in 2019. In fact, one of our listeners that sort of outlined just some of the stuff. And like all of this happened since he last won the major. And like we've sort of been talking about this since 2015, 2016 of, oh, all he needs to do is get the Masters. Like in 2016, there's the birdie putt against Reed at the Ryder Cup and the back and forth between the two of them, that's happened since he last won a major. Then there's the missed eagle putt against Reed at 2018. The drive he hits at the Players on Sunday 2019, the massive hook off the first at Port Rush, which I mentioned on the pod on Tuesday, might still be the one little demon there for McIlroy of going back to Port Rush this year and missing the cut. the shot he hit at 16 at winged foot, and then that interview afterwards where, you know, it just felt like it was a different McIlroy than we'd almost ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And now I sort of put all of those things, what happened to Portrush, what happened with that interview, I sort of put all that down to the Masters and the weight of expectation that he's been under since 2014. And then we get into even in the last 12 months, with Pinehurst been the peak of the pain. But
yeah,
he then goes to the Olympics and he's put himself in the position to win a medal, and he just dunks a wedge straight in the water.
Yeah.
And then the Irish Open, he's cruising, and out of nowhere, Rasmus Højgaard comes in, just runs him over. And then the same thing happens at Wentworth the week after that. Like, it's just this, I was saying, like, this unlimited heartbreak. And to think that this, like, I would struggle to think of any individual. I would have been almost quite worried, and I'm sure there would have no need to be, because for McIlroy, if Rose had won that playoff.
Yeah, oh, just in terms of his mental state.
Oh my, like that. Like
put
that.
Put him on a 24-hour watch.
It's just as big a public humiliation as you could possibly go through.
I totally agree. I think, when you talk about the game of inches, right? I mean, it's now granted he gave it away a bunch of times, but the way he stepped up in the big moments. It is. I mean, the takeaway from all of this, and it's not necessarily a new takeaway for me, but it was just the pressure of being Rory McIlroy is astounding. And now some people will listen and say, oh, but he's a millionaire and he's got a great wife and, you know, he can have anything he wants and all that stuff. The pressure on him and how public it all is, the burden of that is so tough to imagine. And that's, I think, what makes it so impressive that he keeps coming back, that he kept coming back and he kept struggling. You know, a lot of thoughts running through my head right now. I just think it's so admirable. And as you kind of alluded to there, he always was himself. And a lot of people, and I think that's what makes people love him. I think that's why he's such a charismatic figure. It's also what makes some people not like him, right? I had to laugh at McGinley's cup of tea comment and the sort of everything that stirred up. But he is. I mean, you see it all the time. Live people hate Rory McIlroy, right? They hate. But it's almost like a successful politician who has charisma, where it's like some people love him and the people that don't like him really don't like him because he keeps winning. Or, you know, he always kind of shines through. Rory didn't keep winning, but Rory's personality always came through. There was always something about him that was, you couldn't quench it. And I think that's what's so great about this. You couldn't quench who Rory McIlroy was, and he stayed in there, and he took his blows, and he never really, he had his emotional moments, but even his emotional moments running away from the press in Pinehurst or whatever, even those felt like this is true to who this guy is, right? He is wearing his heart in his sleeve. Even being the spokesman for the PGA Tour while other people were silent, he's being who he is. He just, you know, he doesn't, it wouldn't suit him not to say something, not to talk about it. Even the changing opinions, it is who he is. And through it all, he was always himself, and he did it, right? He did it, and he did it his own way. He didn't change who he was. I think it's a wonderful story, whether you love him or you hate him. I think it's a wonderful story. That just, you know, as I wrote in Golf Digest, I don't know if you saw it, Nathan, but when are we going to get a story like this again in golf?
In sport?
When? I mean,
I wonder, are so, listen, without blowing, and if ever there's a time to blow smoke up his ass, it's now. But so lucky in golf to have a Rory McIlroy at a time when sports stars across the board, whether it's in this country and GAA players who is amateurs, there's little or no access to, up to Premier League footballers. I'm sure it's quite similar in America. Like, access is more and more restricted. We know less and less about the sporting heroes than we ever have before in a real way. And I mean, we probably feel we have more access to them because they're on social media, but it's all very performative and it's what they want you to see. Whereas you've always got the sense with McIlroy, you're getting that fully rounded experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And that was why it was so cathartic. I mean, to see him win, I think a lot of us probably have complicated feelings about Rory. He's been such an omnipresent part of our lives if you're covering golf for the last decade. But it doesn't matter. I think it all washed away. A little bit like Tiger, really, in 2019. It all washes away in the glow of victory and how momentous it is. It is, you know, I wrote this too, Nathan. It's, we talked about, you know, what if he had blown that? Well, it had gotten to the point where after Pinehurst, if you're writing the story of Rory McIlroy, you can't, there's nothing interesting about him losing anymore. It's just the same repetitious pain. I mean, yeah, you could argue, oh, well, now he's lost a different way. Now he was leading the final round of Augusta. But really, I mean, I think Pinehurst was the peak of the pain. It doesn't get much worse than that. This would have been redundant. This would have been gratuitous. It was time for him to win, you know, but the author of it all, right? If you believe whatever you believe, whether it's just chance or whether this is some kind of, you know, unbelievable writing, they made you sweat for it. They couldn't give it to you easy. And that felt perfect, too.
Can I ask you this? And I'm obviously looking at things through an Irish tint, and yeah. You were looking at it through an American tint. I was asking the question whether any sports person ever had gone into their big moment with more pressure on their shoulders than McIlroy on Sunday at Augusta. And I know it's impossible for us to compare because, you know, I'd said a Messi at a World Cup final and the weight of his nation on his shoulders, whereas everyone wanted, you know, Rory, or well, maybe there was some division, but most people wanted him to do well. You know, that real weight of the nation on your shoulders, I'm sure, yeah, is enormous. But for his own head, it's hard to think of how you could have more pressure on your shoulders than what he had to deal with when he woke up on Sunday morning.
No, I don't think so, because, you know, there's a big difference between a team sport. You know, let's say, you know, Messi could have had a great game and his team lost and everybody goes, well, but we all kind of understand it's idiotic to be like, oh, Messi couldn't lead his team to victory, right? Like, you know, it's 11 people. It's just like in football when they blame a quarterback. You know, it takes a good defense too. It takes everything. You know, Rory, it's all on his shoulders. He's going to win or lose that himself. And he had a lead. I think the pressure was enormous. And he talked about the pressure he felt. It's the reason he made double bogey on the first hole. He was affected by the pressure. He's been affected by the pressure. He'd say that himself. So, no, I can't think of one offhand, Nathan. I mean, you got a decade leading into that, a decade of pressure leading into it. And here you have your best opportunity. That's what I'm talking about. The stakes were unbelievably high. I can't remotely think of anything that I would compare it to.
What was the American TV viewing experience like?
Yeah, it was. I watched with a group of friends. I wasn't at Augusta. This is sort of my bargaining chip. I've told you, like, I don't often go to Augusta, but I go to all the others in the Ryder Cup, and that's good by me. But, you know, this one, maybe I made a mistake. Yeah, I had the credential and I gave it away at the last second just so I wouldn't, you know, just to make sure about the.
We should cover this next year. I was like, well, I think we missed the fucking bullet here, lads.
I know. But I really wanted to go to Portrush and I really wanted to go to Bethpage, and I probably would have anyway. So now I'm questioning, like, did I even need to give it up? But honestly, it was great fun watching with my friends. I mean, this is part of the thing I talked about. I like watching the Masters on TV. I had a wonderful time Thursday and Friday watching the feature groups. And then I met up with friends on Saturday and Sunday. We had some beers and we watched, and it was nice to have other people there to experience it with, because it was such a, but what's funny is at home, my wife got into it, who has no interest in golf or sports. And like I had left it on when I left to see my friends around 5 o'clock, and she got into it. So I think it was a universal experience, but, you know, we were living and dying with it. We were having a great time, and it was just, incredible drama. So yeah, TV experience. I think we were chattery enough, and I'm not a good one to comment on that. As far as the announcers or anything, we didn't really hear much of them.
But listen, they had a golf expert, Shane Ryan, in the room. Why would you need the TV? Turn it down and let Shane talk you through it.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
The ultimate personal watch-along. question in here. Considering how quickly Rory raced to 4 majors, does Shane think that Rory would have reached 15 majors over the last decade if he hadn't been burdened by the weight of the career Grand Slam? Feels like the Masters has been a footnote to every achievement of Rory's over the past 11 years.
Well, I kind of almost reject the premise of that question because, you know, having to deal with the burden of the career Grand Slam is part of the deal, right? I mean, I'm trying to remember. So Tiger won at Augusta in 97. Mm. Then he won, what, the PGA in 99, and then just immediately won the U.S. Open in British the next year.
So,
right?
So I suppose that's
his very first shot at the career Grand Slam, he dotted the I. Yeah. That was at, wasn't it at St. Andrews in 2000?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was his very first shot at the career Grand Slam because he had just won his first U.S. Open at Pebble. So that's part of it. Now, what's true about the question is that the longer it goes, the more weight gets put on it. So, you know, Rory, I think probably over the last 10 years, looked back at 2011 saying, my God, I could have ended it that day. You know, but that was part of his process. And we talk about resilience and coming back, his very next tournament, he won Zakiwa, right, at the U.S. Open, and he just dominated everybody right after that 2011 Masters. So, no, I don't think he would have gotten to 15. I don't. He is an all-time great player, but he's not Tiger Woods level. He wasn't going to get there. He's had his chances over the years, but it's possible to exaggerate how many chances he's actually had. If you count up the number of majors he could have won, technically, you know, maybe you could get to five before here. Let's be conservative and say that. Even if you're Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus, you don't expect to win all five of those. If you're lucky, you win three of them. So I think Rory, you know, without this strange sort of pressure and what it did to him and a little bit of bad luck along the way and all the stuff that happened over the last 10 years, I think you could be looking at a guy who maybe had seven or eight now. I think that's probably fair.
I wonder. The career Grand Slam, so, you know, Gene Sarazen, as Fionn pointed out, won the career Grand Slam 40 years after he last won his last major, because this suddenly became a thing. And right, as you say, right, Tiger, yeah, who was the last to win it and the only one really of the modern era, won it straight away because he was just, listen, on a different level to everybody else.
Like, yeah,
I sort of do wonder, like, would Rory have won Pinehurst if this wasn't a thing? If it feels like it's been the dominant talking point for almost all of that 10-11 year spell. And then everything just sort of falls out of Augusta because it's the first major. It dominates the chat all the way through the winter. And then there's this massive air of disappointment after he doesn't do it. And, but he just needs to win a different one. Win a PGA and then it'll be easier for you to win a Masters, became the conversation for the last 4 or 5 years. I do wonder with how he spoke about his thought process about going to Augusta and the impact and the pressure he felt on Sunday, whether this was dominating his life almost as much as it's been dominating our conversation for the last 10 years.
I think for sure at Augusta, and I think maybe if you look at Pinehurst, I don't know if I'd say that, okay, Augusta is the one keeping him from it. I think at that point it might be just the burden and the pressure of not having won a major. But I can't get there in my head where not winning the career Grand Slam is the one affecting him at St. Andrews or affecting him at Pinehurst. That to me doesn't quite follow. But I think the broader point of the pressure of all this certainly makes it harder. And the flip side of that, Nathan, as you've thought about, I'm sure, and we've heard a million times, is that now that it's over, if he keeps the same level of focus and seriousness about the game, it does feel like the sky's the limit, because it doesn't matter if he chokes again, right? I mean, he could choke 8 million more times. He got over the line at Augusta. So that, you would think that leads to a certain ease. And now is the time when we can go overboard and go, holy cow, they're playing at Quail Hollow, where he can't lose. He can't lose Quail Hollow. He's going to win that. No, but I mean, really, what a perfect course for him.
But Quail Hollow, just on that, I wonder if that will set the tone for what is to come next, and that rush maybe that we feel could come through over the next couple of years, where he does win another 4 or 5 majors, maybe gets to double figures already, and without trying to look too far ahead, it does feel like, well, Quail Hollow is one of those you need to be winning then.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sets up well for him. I mean, then he has the course record at Portrush, right? I know he didn't do so hot there last time around, but, you know, and then Oakmont, whatever. I mean, that's just a really tough course, so it's hard for everyone. But, yeah, I think it's interesting. You wonder, because it seems like it's ripe for a letdown as well. I mean, and you wouldn't be upset at that. You'd be like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, with a couple of extra days to think about this, and you know, so running on adrenaline for the first while, sort of sitting down in the cold light of day and thinking, okay, to get to 10, like, again, look at the golf that Scotty has played over the last 3 years, and he's only won 2 Masters. Now, the great thing is, obviously, Rory's going to get to play the Masters for the next 25 years, and he now knows how to play that golf course. And you just look at that leaderboard again, and it's full to the brim of former champions who are comfortable at Augusta. So he's definitely going to have more chances there. But it is bloody hard to win these majors. And I had mentioned that, you know, maybe the one demon he has, which I think is exaggerating, it is Portrush, where, as you say, like at 16, he was able to break the course record and hit a 61. And he goes there in 2019 and he has a quadruple bogey off the first. And that's that. But these are difficult things to win. Like, they're, you know, Tiger got to 15 because he went on this mad spell in the space of a couple of years where he won lots and lots and then sort of added bit by bit over time.
And yeah, and the thing to remember with Tiger is that he won all of them except the last one, I guess, from leading after 54 holes. Mm. So these were dominant performances. These weren't ones where it was a coin flip and he won all of them, right? A vast majority of them were blowouts or near blowouts where he's just basically playing conservatively on Sunday, shooting a 70 and waltzing to it because he was so good the days before. That's not a reality in today's golf ecosystem. Rory is not going to be carrying 54-hole leads into all these majors. Yeah. He's going to have to fight tooth and nail for all of them. And there's going to be great players. And you even look at yesterday, or you look at Sunday, and while we grant the fact that he gave away a lot of shots, based on the way he played, so much had to go right for him. Where it's like Scheffler had to stumble, Oberg had to stumble, Bryson had to stumble. You know, Bryson, I think, had to shoot if Bryson had shot a 70, he would have won the Masters, right? I mean, that would have gotten to 12 under, and Rory shot a 73. Mm. The amount that had to, it was a little bit like Tiger's win in 2019, where the amount that was happening across the course, even looking at Patrick Reed, where he was on this crazy run, and he had this weird hole out at 17 coming, and he three putts on 13, where he really, you felt like he was going to make birdie after a really good layup and approach. It was a confluence of factors that had to align for Rory to win. So, I mean, this is what has to happen at every major. There's no winning a major without luck. So I think it's possible to run away in our heads. I would still, you know, he's got 10 good years left in him. I would still say getting to 10 is going to be an enormous task. We wouldn't put it past him, but I kind of, like you said, like there's no time to rest, you know, like start at Quail Hollow. don't wait.
I've definitely come back down to earth a little bit. Now, the fact that his game seems to be in such good shape and doesn't seem to be trending the way almost every other golfer of his generation has, where you have this short spurt and then you kind of disappear and you might pop up on our screens every so often, like a Spieth or a Day or even a Justin Rose, where you get into contention, but you're not really, like, he is still at the very peak of his powers. But that's not going to last forever. And Scottie Scheffler is going to come back. Scottie Scheffler is going to get towards his best again. And I wonder, is there a different type of pressure that comes now? Like, it's, you know, the mentality of someone like McIlroy isn't, it couldn't be just that suddenly he goes into freewheeling now of, oh yeah, I'll just turn up to Quail Hollow and win this. Like, he's going to Quail Hollow going, whew, okay, I've won one. I know how to play this course inside out. I'm going to be the overwhelming favorite to win this. Yeah. Everyone's expecting. And then you got to deal with another kind of thing of, oh, you start with a 74 into Thursday. Oh, was that a freak? Was that, like, look, I'm getting well ahead of myself now. And he could just blow the field apart. But that's the reality of how sport moves. Yeah. Like, we're all enraptured by what we saw on Sunday night. But it moves on quickly, and particularly in golf, where you've got three majors coming up in the next 3.5 months.
Absolutely. I would just hope that when he's in contention again and the nerves are highest, there is a certain ease, and I think there will be, of the consequences of losing are never going to be as dire again. That's the freedom he's given himself.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
Hopefully that has an effect.
Rory on Sunday was a televised example of every golfer in the weekend comp who's had a few good holes and proceeds to ruin it. Ultimately, every golfer is playing against himself. Usually they don't come back after collapse. Can Shane think of any previous examples of a player bouncing back so often with so much on the line?
Yeah. Well, you know, Rahm make, you know, well, I guess that was the first hole of the tournament, though, wasn't it, when he made double bogey and won Augusta. You know, there, I do think, put on the spot, I'm not going to be able to think of one, but I actually do think it's more common than you think in golf. I think if you look at most majors, like even Scotty, you know, there was like, he had some adversity in his Masters.
That stands out, and listen, I think McIlroy is on another level because,
when
we spoke on Friday, it sort of felt like he'd already had his collapse, that was it. Mm-hmm. Like, he'd had the double bogeys in 15 and 17, and if he was to show resilience, it was to get back on Friday and Saturday, and he did all of that. And then he had, you know, two more sort of generation-defining moments on 13 and 18, both of which could stick with you forever if you don't win this tournament. And came through that. So there's very few players who've managed to bounce back that often. But as you say, the way golf works, like Harrington and Carnoustie.
Yeah, you have to.
Harrington and Garcia, both of them in Carnoustie. Like, Harrington stands up on 18 and has a double bogey. Now, look, I'm one of the most difficult golf courses on the world, and he thinks he's blown it because Garcia then standing up in 18 and he's got a one-shot lead. But yeah, fortunately for Harrington, Garcia blows it to an even greater extent, and then you've got to go into a playoff. So, like, that's again, we would never, like, we would all say Harrington's one of the most mentally resilient players there has ever been.
Yeah,
ever been.
Yeah.
And that happened to him. And imagine what his life and his career would have looked like if Garcia just stood up and played 18 and parred it.
Just made a normal par. That's the thing. It's also interdependent, and we fit the narratives on it afterward, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. That's why Tiger was so great. He was just dominant. There were clean victories. There was no question. Rory's had some like that too. The one that just came to mind for me was John Daly and Constantino Rocca. I'm not saying Daly collapsed or anything, but for Rocca to hit that putt to send it to the playoff, it's just an unbelievably devastating moment when you're watching. And you can go back and see it on YouTube. And Daly is there with his wife or his girlfriend or whoever he was with at the time and just looks crestfallen and heartbroken. There's no shine on it. You know, he doesn't buck up and go, okay, time to go play. He is just absolutely devastated. And then he goes and wins, right? I mean, so it's, you never quite know. And it, that ability to come back is a key component. But you're also right that, you know, the stat we heard all week was nobody's made two double bogeys in one Augusta. Well, this guy made four.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like this is a whole different level. And that's Rory. That's Rory.
And that, like, the Constantino Rocca example is a great one because maybe nobody has shown more resilience than Constantino Rocca hitting that putt on 18. But it's right, forgotten about because ultimately John Daly managed to somehow get it together.
It is. There are interesting moments of like that in sports where you think if this had gone a different way, somebody basically didn't capitalize on something spectacular, and you think if this had gone a different way, this would be one of the most famous things in golf history or sports history. And instead it's like, oh no, he just went and lost anyway.
As called out by Rory, the lack of phones at the Masters no doubt contributes to the atmosphere. Does Shane think any other majors could or would take the phones out of the fans' hands?
They should. I totally agree with him about that. It makes it so much purer as people living in the moment. I'm one of those like Luddites right now, and I have a phone. Okay, I'm not any different than anyone, but and I'm always on my laptop. I way too much screen time. I just see how it's just ugly. I think when everybody's sitting around there in a special moment, everybody's got their phones out, along with the stupidity of it. Of, you know, this is on TV, right? You don't need to tape it. You don't need to tape it. You can tell people you were there. It'll be fine. But it also, it just takes you out of it. I mean, in normal life, it kind of alters our way of communicating. I think for young people especially, it's so bad. You know, our kids are not getting phones. It just goes on and on. It's like, yeah, I think what he said, just another example of Rory's intelligence of pinpointing that, of how pure it is that people were just there experiencing that moment together. And if you listen to the No Laying Up guys talk about it after, they were just kind of saying, you know, they're making friends with all these other people that were watching and just, you know, having this shared emotion and this triumph that everybody got to experience. And that wouldn't have been as possible without phones. So I totally, totally with Rory there. I wish they would all take the phones away.
Yeah. It is a weird thing, I'd imagine, though, if you're there as a spectator and you're relying on the leaderboard to tell you what's happening. It is probably what we've touched on a couple of times over the last few weeks about, look, the best experience of watching a golf tournament is more often than not on the TV, that you've just got the golden ticket to go to Masters Sunday and Rory McIlroy's just put it in Rae's Creek on 13 and you're the last person in the world to hear about it, even though you're at the tournament.
But isn't there, don't you envy them though, a little bit, that sense of anticipation? Like, I don't know if they show this on your broadcast, I'm sure they did, but where the score goes up and everybody cheers, you know, everybody's waiting and this score, it's all down to a scoreboard operator putting a number up, and it has such an emotional effect on everybody. That, I think that is just like the most brilliant thing. I just think it's so cool. You lose something for sure, but I think you gain quite a bit too. And that experience would, to be a spectator there would have been a patron, would have been just the experience of a lifetime.
Next question. Is Mab McNealy the most anonymous top 10 player ever? Careful not to say the word worst. Yeah, well, listen, there's no worst if you're a top 10 player.
That's right. Wasn't it you and I who were laughing the other day about that, where there was some question that had us going to the world rankings, and we were both like, what? How is Matt McNeely number 10?
We were trying to decide, who did we go for and are going to miss the cut picks?
Yeah, that's right.
I went for Ludwig. Which,
and I went for Xander, I think.
Also incorrect.
Also, yeah, I don't think any of them missed the cut as I'm looking now. But yeah, McNeely, it's like looking at his stuff, it's like, yeah, he won last year in Georgia, but he keeps having really consistent results. But it is so funny. I can't think of another person. I mean, we'd have to look through the list, but it's truly staggering that he's number 10 to me.
I owes
a little bit to Liv, let's be honest. He's probably a guy who peaks out at 14 if the Liv guys are still playing, but still.
Oh, max 14, you would have to think. I was trying to find a list, and you know, I saw someone on our Discord suggested David Frost. Again, it's easier to go back and say, here's someone from 30 years ago. And then I saw John Cook was top 10 in the world once upon a time. But then John Cook won 11 times on the PGA Tour.
Right.
So it's more actually, well, John Cook never won a major, and when he came second in an Open, it doesn't feel like one of the preeminent players of that generation. So he's sort of like has like Sam Burns got to top 10 in the world?
Yeah, like someone like that. I think it's also tough to judge in retrospect, because you would forget about somebody like John Cook. But we're looking at the present, and we're both still like Matt McNeely. So it's like, it's more, if you're looking at it now and you're still shocked, I think that's kind of, you know, Matt McNeely has not won 11 PGA Tour events. You know, I think he's won one. And it was a fall event, right? I may be wrong about
this. No, the RSM Classic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's the only one he's won. It was last fall. So this is, you know, how he got to top 10 is just an insane amount of good finishes without winning, and then Liv.
I also feel that Maverick McNeely, there's like a 5-year part of his career that I seem to have missed, where when I saw he was top 10 in the world, I was like, oh yeah, Maverick McNeely, sure, he was this brilliant amateur player, and he's only like 22, and he's going to go on and have this great career. He's sort of like a right. Ludwig Light. And then I realized, actually, Matt McNeely had 29. That moment like 8 years ago.
Yeah,
and
100%.
Then just became a sort of journeyman PGA Tour player, and somehow, as you say, has strung together a load of decent results and finds himself as the 10th best player in the world.
I have this thing where I wrote about it in the Masters preview, where there are certain players that are about 8 years older or 7 years older than they should be. Aaron Rye is one for me, where maybe if you're in Europe, it's not the same, but Aaron Rye for me, I'm like, I didn't hear about this guy until last year, and now he's doing well everywhere. Like, what a great 23-year-old or 22-year-old. And he's like 30, you know, and you're like, oh, what? How is Aaron Rye? Aaron Rye shouldn't be 30. And there just are certain guys like that.
Yeah, you're going to have a lot of that, I think, with the European players coming over. It's like, oh, he's obviously come through the Corn Ferry just straight out of college. It's like, he's been a journeyman on the European Tour and had one very good season and suddenly found himself getting all these opportunities in America.
Yep. Like, Richard Bland is only like 24, right?
part of the problem for Maverick McNeely. So Maverick McNeely's best ever finish in a major is tied for 23rd at the PGA Championship. He's top 10 in the world, and he didn't even qualify for the U.S. Open last year.
That's so crazy. You look at his finishes, and it doesn't really make sense still. So he won the RSM, and he's had a second and a third, a T9. But then he's got a bunch of 52nds, 40ths, a couple missed cuts, tied for 32nd. You know, it's sort of baffling how he got up that high that fast. I guess he's just had enough top 10s to accumulate a lot of points, and that's all it takes. But he does strike me as, if he has three bad weeks, he'll be number 50th or something.
Do you think, and I need to be careful, obviously, with the libel lawyers, but Maverick McNeely, it's fair to say, comes from money.
I think that's right. I think, oh man.
So his father co-founded Sun Microsystems, which he sold to Oracle for $7.4 billion in 2010, when $7.4 billion was $7.4 billion. Do you think maybe as part of that, he somehow has access to the world rankings algorithm and has just sort of crunched a few numbers here and there?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, his dad's a computer whiz. They could be running some scam. Now, I don't want to get you guys sued. No, it is funny.
I'm going to do this sometime. I'm going to pick like 10 players from the top 50 in the world, their photograph, and I'm going to bring it into my golf club and see how many people in there can name them.
I would enjoy doing that myself, because I think, I don't know, I definitely would not get all 100.
I was just going to say, if somebody did it to me, I'm wondering how many I know.
Like, if you, like, right now I'm looking, if you showed me Laurie Kantor, I think I'd have real trouble knowing
and,
who that
and
is.
Especially if they took their hat off.
That's right. If with no hats, like, who's Jacob Bridgman, right? I mean, these are all things I probably should know. Samuel Stevens at 78, I've no, he's an American.
I don't even think I've ever heard the name Samuel Stevens before.
That's what I'm saying. There's no possible way I could identify him. Justin Lower, it would be tough. I think conservatively I could get 90, but I bet there'd be anywhere from 5 to 10 that embarrassed me.
Yeah, if Harry Hole took the hat off, I'd definitely be struggling.
I think, but isn't Harry Hall distinctive looking enough that, no, you would know with that shaved head and the maybe facial hair. I think you'd get him. Maybe. He has like a soul patch, doesn't he?
Look, this isn't very, it doesn't reflect on us very well whatsoever.
That's all right.
It reflects poorly on the game of golf more.
That's right. Yeah. Well, would you know the 100th best Premier League player, right? I mean,
100th best Premier League player, I would definitely know.
Oh, really? Well, okay. Fair enough.
They don't wear hats.
Right. That's a good point.
Final question, and you know, it's sort of the theme of this podcast, and eventually we'll wear you down. Eventually what we'll do is we'll find you in Bethpage. We'll be in a pub in New York on the Sunday night of the Ryder Cup, and Shane will be in the corner, crouched over in tears, with a load of Europeans just shouting abuse at him. Because your boys will have let you down. Does Shane hope Canada becomes the 51st state so Connors, Taylor, and Hadwin can add some strength to the Ryder Cup team?
I mean, do those guys add strength to the Ryder Cup team? Corey Connors, you know, has some good finishes, but I mean, you kind of need to be able to putt on these events, as we've seen from him in President's Cups. No, look, the European year continues. I think, let me tell you, I have learned this the hard way. Don't joke with Canadians about being acquired. I mean, it is like, it's kind of a funny concept in some ways to us, because we see it as a goofball thing that's never going to happen. But I don't know. If the British Prime Minister was like some crazy person who started joking about acquiring Ireland, I think, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's hard.
I think
for
the
Americans.
Politics might be even deeper there.
Well, no, for sure. There's no doubt that would be way worse. But I think as an American, it's hard to understand, because we don't have some powerful neighboring country that in theory could take us over if it ever came to it. But I have a lot of Canadian friends, and man, oh man, they're not, this is not a source of humor to them, but, I don't know. Who would you add among those guys? I don't know if those guys would be such a great add.
No, all of the Canadians feel to me like the type of person you back in a major at 50-1, because you've seen enough of them to suggest that they have the talent, but they never seem to have that real cutting edge.
Yeah. One of the few things that went as expected to me was Corey Connors, how he played on Sunday. It was just exactly what I expected in a tournament where nothing was.
You've got to be getting a little bit worried. Your boys are screwed. Like, you know, you're basically staking your hopes on Russell Henley, who was essentially the worst player at the Masters.
You don't understand. It doesn't matter. None of this matters. I'm trying to convince you, Nathan. All the years Europe won, you know, in Europe or in the U.S., when they had by far the worst players, America won all four majors. It doesn't matter in the Ryder Cup. Look, the margins are so small, okay, that in the Ryder Cup, it doesn't, you know, you're looking back, oh, yeah, but Rory and Rose were in a playoff. Rory won, you know, the players. A bunch of Europeans won other events during it. Maybe he'll win the next three majors, too. It doesn't matter. It's the home field advantage, man. That's all that counts.
Lots more Ryder Cup chat to come, because, well, we can't do the whole Rory at Augusta thing for ever again. It's going to be quite a ride line for the winter.
We can do so much Rory this year, though, right? I mean, I feel like we've only entered the beginning of our Rory obsession. Going into the Wells Fargo or going into the PGA at Quail. Yeah, I mean, I just think Rory hype should just be absolutely peaking right now.
All right, we are going to leave it there for the Ryan line. Shane, thank you as ever. We shall talk to you next week. Get your questions in the Discord channel and send them to golfweekly@offtheball.com. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Nathan.
starter kit right here.